was a poem you ended with, she wore a rose-tinted crucifix. Was that about Mary Magdalena, the Virgin Mary, or, you know, the Mother of Christ?
A rose?
Rose-tinted crucifix. It was in your poem.
Well, the rose is a symbol. The rose is a symbol for me, like it was for Yeats, I think. And it was my grandmother's name. And I don't have roses now, but I love roses. And
the rose is a symbol of the Virgin Mary, so I'm wondering if...
Oh, yeah. So, well, I suppose so, yeah.
A double meaning there.
Subliminally, yeah, but rose is a symbol for a lot of things. And yes, that's one of them. That's what Rilke wrote about that, yeah.
The rose window in the cathedral in France.
The rose window. And I had a poem I wanted to read about, because it's got a not deliberate rhyme about Notre Dame and... the nave of Notre Dame and the summit of the pyramid at Teotihuacan. Those are the two sacred places that I love so much. Yeah. Anyone ever been to Teotihuacan? Yeah, you know, it's 35 miles out of Mexico City, and the pyramids, there's two pyramids. They're bigger than anything in Egypt, and they were built in 800 AD.
What's the name of them?
Teotihuacan. That was a civilization long before the Aztecs came to Mexico City. The problem is, when you're on the top of the Sun Pyramid now, you look down on the Mexican equivalent of Costco. The board for that is sort of sad, you know, it's just a way.
So you were talking about the tracks that went to San Bernardino that they pulled up. So yesterday or today in the Gloucester Times, somebody found the trolley tracks when they were doing...
I read that.
Washington Street. It's the same thing. The guy recognized them because...
Yeah, I read that. And so that's the other thing about poetry is like a... You know, the Olson collection that Kate Grossman put up, The Archaeologist of Mourning. A poet is an archaeologist, in a way, because they're digging up the past and they dig into the earth and they find things. And I thought that was a great title. And it was a great collection. Now, of course, it's been subsumed by the collected Olson, but even to the point of Olson going to Mexico and studying the Mayan glyphs, you know. I mean, he had that sense of history. Anyone else, any comments or questions? Anybody?
Thank you.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I wasn't a bigger draw. I'm you never know what's going to happen. I'm disappointed. I probably would have been more of a showman. I mean, I did my best, but if there's like 20 more people, you feel, you know, you're sort of walking on the scene. I got to be honest.
I think you had 20 people in here.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
You were streaming. Live streaming. So it was streamed over the internet when you read it.
Yeah, there'll be more people. Yeah,
you
there'll be.
Live, though.
I never heard of you before, and I'm really glad I came.
Thank you.
You've given me a lot, and the thing about the Jewish thing.
Thank you.
My father would always work Jewish.
And stick around.
Well, Joseph Campbell, and he'd go, he's anti-Semitic. And I'd say, well, Ezra Pound another time. He's anti-Semitic. And T.S. Eliot, he's anti-Semitic. My father would tell me everybody was anti-Semitic. He was very angry at those people. I mean,
it's funny. The last time I went to Italy to read, I went with Agneta Falk, who's the wife of Jack Hirschman, our great poet, one of our great poets in San Francisco. If I say our great poet, I'm leaving me out. So we went to Italy, and you have 7 minutes. You know, 7 minutes to read, so I'm happy for, you know what I mean? And then I was in Chicago last week, and, you know, I haggled with the guy, and I ended up getting quite a sum of bread, but it was only one thing I said, bring me to some classes. This doesn't make any sense. I'm coming to a convocation, and I knew there wouldn't be a lot. There were like 35 people, because the kids, they see the thing, poet visiting, they can't go anywhere. So I went and did a class on Bukowski, which I really enjoyed, but I literally begged him to try and put me in two or three more classes. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm so generous, but on the other hand, I am.
In Rome?
I wanted to do it. I wanted to meet more students. I always feel there'll be one person that I'll draw out that'll stay with poetry. So I met one young lady in one class where we've been corresponding, and she writes some pretty good poems, and that's where it is to me. That's where it is.
Was it in Rome?
Say what?
Were you reading in Rome?
No, no, I was just in
Chicago.
Chicago. Okay. Yeah, this guy was into, he wanted to do a, we had a big Ferlinghetti celebration, as you can imagine, in San Francisco. And I saw it was happening, and I saw this list of people at the library. And I emailed them, and I said, why don't you have me? And they wrote me back in 5 minutes, you're on. And then 5 minutes later, they said, would you be the MC? And I thought, my God, I went from being out to running the goddamn thing, and they're giving me $100. Nobody else got paid. But the thing I didn't realize was, immediately I got phone calls and emails, mainly emails, I have to begging me to read. And then somebody wrote and said, you're in charge, you put this together, why did you leave me out? And I wrote back and said, I'm not, I didn't have anything to do with it. But it was fun. It was fun. And I was able to stand up there, and you know, I said one thing. I said, Ferlinghetti came up to me one day, several years ago, he said, I always wanted to ask you about that poem of yours I published in City Lights Review. What did it mean? And I told him what I thought it meant, and he said, if I'd known that, I never would have published it. So that was one of the things I was able to say. And then I called him after all the events. They had another reading at City Lights. I was the last reader. And I called him up, and he's 100 years old. And he answered the machine. And I said, thank you for Coney Island of the Mind in 1958. Yeah. And thank you for the keys to Bixby Canyon at Big Sur. That's the cabin where Kerouac wrote the novel Big Sur. There's an outhouse there signed Allen Ginsberg, Jean-Louis Kerouac, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Gregory Corso, and yours truly, Neely Tchaikovsky. And Jesse was there with me once. And it's a little cabin. I said, thank you for that. And then I said, I had to force myself to say it, but I meant it. I mean, the guy's 100 years old, and he's been my friend, and a mentor. And I said, I love you, Lawrence. It was hard for me to say that to my father, let alone to somebody, another man. I mean, I've said it to many men, but on a different level, you know. And so I said, I love you, Lawrence. And he said, well, I love you too, Neely. And that was worth it to me. That was really worth it, you know. He's sort of like an initiatory bridge for a lot of us. And I'll never forget that he wrote this great, he's extremely left-wing, Lawrence, and he's run this great enterprise, and yet he wrote one of the great tributes to another poet is about Ezra Pound reading at Spoleto in 1967 when he was very old. You know that poem?
Yes.
You know that poem, Pound at Spoleto?
Yes.
And the recording, if you listen on Penn Sound, Pound is incredible, you know. He said, the scientists are in terror and the European mind stops. Wyndham Lewis taking blindness rather than let his mind stop. Night under wind, mid-graffiti, the petals are almost dry. Mozart, Linnaeus, Sulmona. How can there be peace in the world when one's friends hate each other? And he went on like that, and you could hear a pin drop. You know, and he ends that poem. I should have read the whole thing, but it's too long. In meine Heimat, in my own country, where the dead walked and the living were made of cardboard. He was looking back on America that had put him in the asylum for 15 years, where he was visited by 5 Nobel Prize winners. Amazing.
Didn't he have the kettle drums at Spoleto too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's so transcendent.
Yeah. So, you know, Ferlinghetti is just great, and I don't know how long he's going to last.
He's 100?
Yeah, we just had his birthday.
100 years old. I mean, he's losing his sight and his hearing, and that's what happens when we're older, you know, if we're still alive. Because Allen left at age 70, Corso was 70, Kerouac 47. I mean, you go down the list of some of our great, what Dylan Thomas, 40. It's amazing. Rambo gave it up at what, 19? And I say it in the thing here, you know. He just gave it up. And he spoke of poetry only once in a letter. One time.
Well, the other story about Rambo is he survived as a gun dealer in the Middle East.
Part of that, yeah, a little bit. He did a little bit of that, and you know, they sent him home. All he lost his leg from gangrene, and
yeah,
all that kind of thing. But it's a mystery, you know. You know, one wonders, you know, why did he leave all that? You know, and Philip Whalen stopped writing the last. Such a great poet, the last 20 years of his life. And I don't know about you other poets. The thought of not writing is crazy. It's just, you know, it's not possible. You know, it's sort of a selfish activity in a sense, but that idea again of wanting it shared and read and the connections that we have. I went into the library there and I found these Origin magazines that I had only heard about. I never held one, and I started reading. Even though I knew the poems, I didn't know them in the context of their publication, this little stapled magazines that Sid Corman did. And it starts with Olson, who sort of orchestrated. Olson bullied his way into it. He said, "You gotta have me as the number one guy, you know. And then you gotta have Robert Creeley, and then you gotta have Duncan." So he shared the wealth as it was, but you know, making those connections are so important. So I'm building my own questions and answers. It's lovely. But you've been a great help, really.
Well, I think Vincent was connected, Olson, to Corman.
Vincent, right? Yeah.
Don, you know that? Did Vince connect Olson to Corman?
I don't think so. Olson's in the first one. I think Olson horned his way in.
No, it was one, number one. I just was reading it, yeah.
Well, he must have known something about the project, and then he horned his way into it.
And it was amazing reading their letters, because Olson is so
right
on. Hey, this is me. I'm somebody. And he knew who he was. I think he understood what he had done. Though I always thought projective verse had already been in the Pisan Cantos. It had already been done by Pound.
Well, and he did the essay in 1950. Everybody who sort of looked at it and said, wow.
That's what did it. You're right. That's what, yeah, of course,
right.
Yeah.
That was at Poetry New York.
Yeah.
I actually think that his girlfriend, who criticized it a lot, Frances Baldoroff, had a lot to do with the text.
Yeah, I read her letters, some of those.
Oh, yeah.
So she helped put that,
the projector. Yeah.
He's going through the whole thing with her.
And then I guess Olson also helped orchestrate the New American Poetry.
Well, I don't know.
Right? Or not?
Well, Don Allen was a maestro, and he had Grove Press behind him already. So, I mean, Olson was a godsend to building the anthology.
Yeah.
But, you know, anybody who wasn't a Black Mountain poet or whatever in that anthology now says, they didn't give me a label. All my life, I've lived without a label. There are a lot of people in the anthology who were not Black Mountains.
I've heard that, yeah. And my good friend David Meltzer was the youngest person in there.
Yeah, well, and Wieners and Sanders, were they called younger poets?
Younger poets. They didn't like that to be known as a younger poet for
Sanders,
life.
Sanders, Wieners, and I think Meltzer, too.
Neil, did you go to Black Mountain?
I think I'm too young for that. I mean, I may look, you know, the beard makes you 10, 12, I'm convinced that the beard makes you older, which is fine with me.
Thomas Raincrow, they called you a baby beat.
Oh, God, I can't stand it.
Thomas Raincrow, they called you the baby beat.
I like Thomas Raincrow, he's an incredible poet.
In the second San Francisco Renaissance.
Yeah, I hate that title, though.
Yeah, so could you talk on that? I read a review of this book called The Baby Beats in the Second San Francisco Renaissance. I was curious what you might...
I don't think of it. I don't consider...
Baby beat?
Hell, fuck no.
What does that mean? A baby beat.
What does beat mean? I mean, it's
it came from Richard Brodigan, I guess.
Yeah, it was from Brodigan. They're just labels, and then they put it on you.
Don't pay no attention to them. They're baby beats.
I mean, like I said, I go back to, you know, actually, the truth is, I'd be insane if I didn't think of Homer, Dante, Shakespeare, as the people that I measure myself against, my inner self. It doesn't make any sense to think otherwise, in my mind. I'm extremely hierarchical.
What was the second San Francisco Renaissance in the 70s and the 80s that you were part of?
No, we didn't. It's just younger people got together. We came in after the Beats in a way, but we were, the thing about the Beats who were there is they were completely accessible. Just like Bukowski was accessible to anybody. It's sort of a paradox that if you could get to him, because he was trying to live his life, but he would measure himself with somebody as equals. He would never put on that he was greater. Corso would talk to somebody, some young poet, like they were, it's just okay. Allen would act professorial, but he was fine. Ferlinghetti was, I mean, there was great humility.
And Lou Welch and Jack Michelin?
I don't know. I didn't know him.
You knew Jack Michelin, though, right? You knew Jack?
Say what?
Jack Michelin. You know Jack Michelin, though, right?
Yeah. We were very close many times. And, you know, Michelin got sort of second-rated by the whole group. Gregory has a poem that's unpublished that's going to be in his new book that Raymond Foy is putting together. And he says, "You're right, Jack, there are no bad poets." That's that Courtyard ode I read of mine. That comes from that, because he always told Jack he was bad. I met Michelin in 1965. He was living in a third-floor walk-up on Sunset Boulevard. But you see, we talk about the Beats. How many other poets were there? Worthy, incredible poets at that time. And why does the people my age have to have this? That label isn't sticking, the Baby Beats. It isn't sticking. It's not a known. And I'm glad for that. I resent it. I don't like it. Yeah. I don't want to be.
Did you or Brodigam have ideas about Rexroth?
Well, there's a great poet who was short-circuited by the Beat Wave.
Yeah, right.
I mean, he's as good, if not better, than most of them. And
woo!
You know, he wrote "Thou Shalt Not Kill" the same year Allen wrote "Howl." And you know, it's about the death of Dylan Thomas,
right,
and
right.
You know, probably and mentions all these other poets, and he says at the end, "You killed him. You killed him in your goddamn Brooks Brothers suit, you son of a bitch." And his last cycle of poems on Flower Wreath Hill, that's one of the poems that I measure
Neely?
Myself.
Fuck yeah, Neely. That's right.
Yeah, I sit there at night and I think of that poem and I think, I'm going to do that. I'm going to have that.
Yes.
You know, because most poets that I know of don't get better as they get older. They get shallow. Mm-hmm. I think that Allen's last disposition book that my friend Bill Morgan put out, he shouldn't have put it out, in my opinion. I think that the last six books of Bukowski are just that. They're the last six books of Bukowski. It's not good poetry. It's secondary material. And they think crazier and crazier titles. You know, the Rooming House Madrigals is a collection of early poems. Burning in Water, Drowning in Flames, a collection of earlier poems. And now we've put together, Raymond Foy and I have done the collected poems of Kaufman, Bob Kaufman. We have a problem with the coffee house on the rights, but we found 16 poems that are unpublished. There's a Compléat thing, and he's, you know, he just got better and better. And I like to think that I did. In my own case, I don't know about the rest of you, I feel I had an extremely long apprenticeship because I wasn't sure of myself. And early on, I wrote some really nice poems, but most of them weren't. One day, I threw out like this stack of poetry like this. La Mantilla was there, and he tried to stop me. He said, "No, you've got to keep them." And he's a poet I admire so much. He tried to stop me. And he said, "Why are you doing that?" He said, "You could go over there and find a line in each one of those." He said, "That's what I do." But I didn't listen to him. I let it go down the chute. And frankly, I'm sad. I wish that I had saved them. But
Wieners did that a lot.
Wieners
did that a lot. He destroyed a lot of great poetry, as you know.
Yeah, and then there's a poet, Doug Blazek, who was a Bukowski guy from Bensonville, Illinois. You know, he did some of Bukowski's early Mimeo stuff. And he sort of wrote these pretentious books. One was "All Gods Must Learn to Kill." I mean, give me a break. And what he did in the last 30, 25 years, he rewrote his poems in his own voice. And they're beautiful. I just read six of them on Poetry Foundation. They're just beautiful. They're not Bukowski-like. They're him. And I defy anyone who thinks, because I'm like the, I'm like Bukowski's left arm in a sense, you know. And I don't write like him. I think that's pretty at all, you know. And, you know, we have, first of all, there's the gay thing, blah, blah, blah. And all that, and our attitudes, or at least our persona toward women and all that, you know. So, and you can see maybe in my work, I'm not always very narrative, you know. My work works by pastiche, much like Pound and the Pisan Cantos. It isn't a straight narrative, right, you know. Like, I was very cognizant of doing this book that I'm putting together right now, called Hyper. I could write kind of Billy Collins-esque, straightforward narratives, and it might do very well because the title, there's a lot of people with ADD, but I refuse to do that. You know, I just can't bear the thought of that. I mean, you want to be read by people, you want to be understood. That's why Frost was very lucky. He was able to get it all in one package. It's why Pound very early on wrote, if you know the Ballad of the Goodly Fair, he said to himself, I'm going to write a poem that everyone's going to love. And he wrote that rhyming poem on Jesus. You know, we lost the goodliest fair of all for the priest and the gallows tree. A lover he was of brawny men, of ships and the open sea. And it goes on like that. And by God, it did it. You know, many thousands of people loved and read that poem. Whereas his cantos have always just been poets and academicians. Now, people make a mistake. They think of Pound as an academician. It wasn't at all. And even Eliot, you know.